Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. The first part of the show today, we're going to do a little update on vaccination, on the COVID virus itself, a little bit of data about virology, a little bit of a scientific deep dive, rounding up this segment. Let's start with that update I promised you. You may have noticed some tents floating around over at the Skyview Drive-In, and that is, of course, adjacent to the Sutter Hospital, and indeed, Hospital and Surgery Center, I should say. That is a clinic that Sutter PAMF is doing, and it's a mass vaccination clinic. They are taking appointments. You do have to have an affiliation with Sutter, or you have to be a healthcare provider. Dignity will also begin vaccination clinics. In fact, I think they start tomorrow, and those will be at Harbor High. None of these clinics are available as drop-ins. You have to have an appointment, and they are deliberately not wanting you to wait for hours and hours in line if there not be enough vaccine. And there have definitely been some bumps in the distribution. Later on this month, there may be something going on at the fairgrounds down in South County. That is still up in the air, as far as I know, and as far as the clinicians meeting with the public health officers. All of these, and again, I want to emphasize, these will all need appointments, so don't try showing up. It just won't work. We're currently in the very first phases, trying to get that vaccine into the healthcare workers, that is to say also the doctors who don't work at hospitals, the clinics, the staff of those clinics. We're also trying to get visiting nurses, all of the people who are exposed to the public, the sick public, that we want to keep working and keep them from getting sick and certainly keep them from spreading it as they go about their rounds, as they are one of the few groups that does encounter a lot of people. So far, as of yesterday, 7,285 vaccines have been distributed in Santa Cruz County to healthcare personnel. 680 have been distributed to skilled nursing facilities. Over the next week, the CVS and Walgreens will be doing SWAT team-style visits to skilled nursing facilities and other congregate living facilities to try to get out there and get that highly sensitive group. And I do want to take a moment and just remember a wonderful woman, an older lady who I've known for many, many years, mother of a friend of mine, but also a friend of mine, Rach, who passed away a couple of days ago, quietly from COVID, but still from COVID. We're all very sorry to see her go. A little later, I'm going to present you with some statistics about the incredible propensity this virus has to kill certain groups of people. So, in California, we have had a little bit of bad luck just getting things distributed. The first bit of bad luck is one of the, locally, is that we got some Moderna vaccine distributed to us, lot 41L20A, if you want to know. And then that was pulled because I guess there were some additional allergic reactions. So that turned out to be 5,300 of the 6,500 doses that were available in the county. So that was a bit of a setback. More bad luck, this happening up in the San Jose area. A very unfortunate, well-intentioned effort. You may have seen it in the newspaper, but a nurse was trying to cheer up the children, so she put on a Christmas tree costume. Unfortunately, the Christmas tree costume was one of those air-powered inflatables with a battery pack, and the fan blew COVID all over the place, and over 40 hospital personnel came down with COVID. I'm glad it was a pediatric hospital, thank God for that, but nevertheless, just goes to show that we cannot let down our guard, and even people who are very intelligent don't necessarily think about the wind that they're creating with their lovely Christmas costume, trying to cheer everyone up, but not very successfully. I had a little bit of personal bad luck this week. I got a rather draconian letter from the medical board. Fortunately, it was a form letter. Everybody with a medical license in the state got one. And basically, it said, hey, if we catch you selling vaccine or not following the orders of the local health officer or in any way cheating, we'll pull your license and then we'll talk. But as I said, pretty draconian, and I guess they're trying to get in front of things that may have happened in other states. I haven't really heard any published stories, or maybe it's just fear of human nature, the uglier side of same asserting itself. So let's talk about this concept of delaying the of the vaccine itself, and whether this idea that was floated last week of delaying a second vaccine. So the real question here is, if we don't have enough vaccine, what's the best move? Should we go ahead and give it one vaccine to twice as many people? That way, people won't necessarily get as good an immune response, but you'll have a broader immune response. That's what they decided to do in the United Kingdom, because there's a new coronavirus variant that's more contagious than the other versions. So their idea was, well, let's get as many people somewhat immunized so that they are not super spreaders, so that we can keep the transmission rate down. Concern, of course, is that this could lead to that partial immunity causing, let's call it a permissive situation, for the virus to mutate, and we could get, you know, the virus being less likely to respond to the vaccine. The idea here is, if people have full immunity as a result of vaccination, their immune response is robust, and they get large numbers of neutralizing antibodies that stop the virus from getting into the cell in the first place, and so the virus doesn't get in, doesn't get replicated. But maybe with a weaker immune response, people would still get infected and replicate. You might get only partial resistance to infections. And we really don't know whether a single shot, how good it is and how long it lasts. According to the data on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, it was about 50% effective after the first dose, and Moderna's was about 80% effective, but they really weren't studying that on purpose. So I'm not sure that this is true. First of all, let's differentiate viruses versus bacteria. Bacteria develop antibiotic resistance in several ways. These are living organisms. They can also trade information if they do figure out a way to defeat a particular antibiotic, and it can be just partially defeated. Then that will get passed on, and they can trade with even other species. That's something that the gut bacteria love to do, trade around DNA. There are different mechanisms, things that they can be trading. Enzymes that break down penicillin are a classic one. Beta-lactamase, it's called, and it basically blocks the ability of penicillin to damage the bacterial cell wall. Also, some bacteria develop pumps. This also happens in cancer cells, by the way. They actually just kick the antibiotic out of the bacteria, or they lose the hooks, just like the ACE2 is the docking station for the coronavirus. Antibiotics themselves have docking stations on the bacteria in some situations. They can also change in the structure so that the antibiotic target is no longer able to be targeted. This is how you get resistance to drugs like azithromycin and the other macrolides. So the point is that bacteria are a living organism, and they have a very, you can debate whether or not viruses are living or not. They are really more like a random walk in terms of their evolution. In the case of the coronavirus, it actually has a proofreader mechanism on its genome, which prevents it from having lots of mutation. This is completely different than flu. But, of course, we're watching this thing like a hawk, and the thing to understand is there's lots of mutations that have been identified. Most of them are neutral or actually handicap or kill off the virus. And so we aren't seeing those rise in the population. If we see something becoming more prevalent in a population, it has some kind of evolutionary or selective advantage. In the case of the English virus, it has the N501Y mutation. This is a spike protein mutation that increases the strength that that spike protein is able to grab onto the ACE2 receptor on the surface of its target cells. Now, that is in and of itself a problem because it's made the virus more contagious. And anything that makes it more contagious, well, off we go. The other hypothesis about this is maybe it makes sense to give as many people as possible the first dose because that's going to reduce the titer. In other words, reduce the amount of virus that anyone's going to be exposed to. And assuming everyone does masking, that might be enough to lower the prevalence of the infection. And so maybe lowering the prevalence of the infection means that there will be fewer coronavirus variants circulating. And also, you don't make as many copies, you aren't going to have as much opportunity for new mutations. And we honestly do not know which is the proper path. I tend to come down on the side of vaccinating everybody once, and then let's hope that that works to reduce the spread, because what we have to do is keep those hospitals from getting flooded. Fortunately for us, that flood rate has actually improved quite a bit in the last few weeks, but we're all very nervous about what happens in the next week. That's really going to tell us we could be in a lull, we could be heading down, nobody knows for sure, and we're just kind of sitting on the edge of a knife, wondering whether the ICUs are going to fill back up again. In the meantime, of course, we're on total, practically complete state shutdown, and everybody is having a bad hair day. I attended a CMA Grand Rounds yesterday, virtual, of course, and there was a wonderful virologist there. This is the State of California virologist, and she was really excellent in helping us understand what we're seeing so far with the two new strains of coronavirus that have been, not the one in the UK, which we're going to talk about again in a minute, but the one in Brazil and the one in South Africa. And virologists are watching these very, very carefully. I'm going to spend a little time talking about a variant that we have in California here called the L452R variant. That's here in the U.S. This one does have increased binding, but it's not the UK virus. It has a bonus in that it seems to be more resistant to the monoclonal antibody products like Regeneron. So it's changed enough that those engineered molecules are not going to do it. Now, let's be clear. When you give the entire spike protein in a vaccine or you get COVID and there's plenty of spike protein around, your immune system doesn't just make one antibody. It makes dozens of different ones, if not hundreds, each one attacking the spike protein from a slightly different angle. So the chances of still having neutralizing antibody are excellent, but the monoclonals don't have that advantage. That being said, the South Africa variant does have us a bit worried. As I said, because in a vaccination or a natural infection, you make antibody that is pluripotent, what we are seeing here with this particular situation is resistance to neutralizing antibodies. Not a total resistance, but some of the antibodies that people have made as a result of infection, because that's what we have available, aren't working. As a result, the other antibodies that people who've had infection or vaccination are making have to take up the slack. This results in requiring a higher dose of antibodies to be completely resistant to this new form. If you are, let's say, at the end, 6 months out from an infection,
your antibodies could potentially have dropped to the point where you don't have enough. We don't know whether your T-cell immunity would be good enough to step in and take over, and we won't know that. That requires a natural experiment. We can't replicate that in the lab. We have to have a natural experiment. But it's an interesting question, and people are watching it very carefully. If you need 10 times more antibody, neutralizing antibody, for the South African one, and we continue to get new mutations where similar sorts of things occur, what we're looking at is booster shots. We're not looking at a repeat of March 2020. So please don't become alarmed. Worst case scenario, by the time we know this, we will have a big supply of vaccine and people will need booster shots, a vaccine that gives them the complete spike protein or the RNA to make the complete spike protein, thus allowing us to kick the immune system in the pants and regrow more antibodies, keep that antibody level up. I mentioned that I was going to talk a little bit about the demographics of this disease. The risks for ICU admission, if you are above 85 versus 18 to 39, are substantially higher, more than double, but only double. And I wanted people look at the death rates and they think, well, that correlates to ICU rates, but it's not at all true. So there's something called a risk ratio, and that means I've got twice as big a chance, 10 times as big a chance. And if you compare the in-hospital mortality risk, because that's really the only numbers we can compare right now. People who get COVID in the community, we don't have any kind of number for that, really. All right, that number is bogus. Whatever anybody tells you, it's dependent on who gets tested. If you compare 85-year-olds to that 18 to 39-year age group, this is where it really gets scary. The risk ratio for in-hospital mortality is 11. That's more than 1,000% more deaths. And it's still, when you look at the 50 to 64 year group and compare them to the 18 to 39, it's still about triple. If you get sick, it's really significant. And we are still in the thick of this particular issue. We're going to shift gears now and do a lovely dive into some really cool science. And the first one is about sensors in animals that detect magnetic fields. The Earth's magnetic field is a result of the movement of liquid iron in the core, molten iron. It moves like boiling water. As it does that, because iron is a magnetic component, it generates a magnetic field almost exactly the way the movement of the alternator or the generator in an internal combustion engine creates electricity. Same exact thing, but we create the magnetic field using this. Many animals are known that they sense the magnetic field, but no one's really known how they do it. Some people even suggest that dogs and cows sense it. But magnetoreception has been a mystery. Some bacteria use a compound called magnetite. It's a magnetic iron oxide, like a little compass needle. And they migrate along, line up on magnetic field lines, which is fascinating. But vertebrates don't have magnetite crystals in their bodies. So it must be a chemical reaction. And that's been the leading hypothesis, but no one's really known what's going on. So it would work like this. If certain molecules get excited, electrons can jump between them and their neighbors. Magnetic fields influence the speed of this exchange and affect the chemical behavior of the molecule. So this could slow down or speed up certain chemical reactions and maybe even change an animal's behavior. In the living cells of animals, there are proteins called cryptochromes. These have been hypothesized to be the magnetic field sensitive molecules. They're a class of photoactive pigments, similar to the rhodopsin that you have in your eye that picks up photons. When they absorb light, they emit a little electromagnetic signal. So based on this property, researchers postulated that they would also be sensitive to magnetic fields because essentially magnetism creates electricity, electricity creates magnetism under the right circumstances. So a team of researchers recently at the University of Tokyo set up a situation where they could observe cryptochrones in a living cell responding to a magnetic field. They created a culture of human cells containing a special pigment used to dye proteins, used to dye cryptochromes. They irradiated the cells with blue light under the microscope so that they were fluorescing. That would be a way that you might detect a cell if you were looking for a particular DNA mutation, or if you were trying to insert DNA, you'd also insert a fluoroscopic dye, and then you'd be able to see which cells had the DNA in it. That's, of course, back in the pre-CRISPR days when we had to worry about such things. Anyway, having set that up, they then swept a magnetic field over the cells. And each time the magnetic field swept over the cells, the fluorescence of the cells dropped about 5%. That means that the protein's activity was reduced. This means that we could potentially create magnetic field switches. And this magnetic field was very, now, yes, it's cell culture. All right, it's not the brain, inside the brain. So they're, you know, very vulnerable, bare cells sitting out there in a culture medium. But nevertheless, it was a weak magnetic field, about the same as a refrigerator magnet. Now, that's much stronger than the Earth's magnetic field, but it's still pretty weak. So a lot of our devices, particularly large generators in electrical power plants, are probably generating enough magnetic field to affect the cryptochromes in the individuals and presumably also affect their physiology a little bit. It's going to be a dose-related problem. The implications for cellular signaling and maybe molecular switches in the body is certainly there. Right now, cryptochrones are used like a molecular clock. Birds use them to see magnetic fields. And that, of course, has been known for a while, but now we actually know how they did it. So it's nice sometime to just talk about science. I promised you some good news about multiple sclerosis. So This research was just reported. It came out of Yale University researcher. His name of the senior author, at least, is David Hafler. Most people are aware that multiple sclerosis is a disease that can cause all sorts of terrible symptoms. It can lead to paralysis, pain, brain dysfunction, vision loss. In fact, that's one of the more common presenting symptoms. Loss of coordination. It's very, very disabling. And what's going on in multiple sclerosis is that the immune system actually makes antibody against myelin. Myelin is the sort of plastic coat on the outside of nerves that acts as an insulator and allows them to send information about 10 times faster than they would otherwise be able to send it. So, you know, if you want to understand what it's like to have multiple sclerosis, go back to those days of dial-up and remember how long it took a web page to load. Well, your nerves are back to dial-up when you have multiple sclerosis, and so your coordination, everything, your balance, and as I said, anything that wants to go wrong can go wrong. It just depends on where the myelin gets attacked. This research was published January 19th in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, and it showed that the attack on the nervous system was highly associated with a lack in the blood and cells of a specific fatty acid. And they were using fat tissue sampling, because, of course, myelin is a fatty tissue, so it seemed logical. The fat tissue in patients diagnosed with multiple sclerosis lacks normal levels of oleic acid, which is a monounsaturated fat that's found in olive oils. It's found in meat, cheese, nuts, eggs, some pasta, milk, olives, and avocados. Of course, it's found in olives. And this omega-9 monounsaturated fatty acid is a big part of the Mediterranean diet. If you don't have oleic acid, it leads to a loss of metabolic sensors that activate the T cells. And the T cells in question are not a killer T cells, they're regulatory T cells. So, you know, when you have an argument with someone at the office or at maybe an employee, employer thing, you call in the mediator to calm things down, get people talking. And that's what the regulatory T cells do. They don't shut down the immune system. They modulate the immune response and stop the immune system from fighting with the self. In this particular study, they noticed the lack of oleic acid because they were looking for it, because they were wondering if there were factors in diet that could affect multiple sclerosis. Well, maybe that's because early multiple sclerosis or the microbiome in people with multiple sclerosis somehow interferes with absorption. Is it causal or is it a result? That's the next question if you should be asking yourself right now, because correlation does not prove cause and effect. So then they proved cause and effect. They introduced oleic acid into the fatty tissues of multiple sclerosis patients who had low levels of oleic acid and increased the levels. And what they saw were increases in the levels of regulatory T cells. So they were able to demonstrate that, I'd say pretty unequivocally, that diet is a factor here. Of course, we know there's a correlation between obesity and multiple sclerosis. It's always thought to be an inflammatory role. I'm inclined to think the microbiome is playing a role in anything that has to do with the immune system. So more study is needed to elucidate the exact mechanism for this. And it's, if you are a person who has multiple sclerosis or has family members with multiple sclerosis, adopting a Mediterranean diet, which is high in omega-9, and also, I might add, making sure that you get plenty of vitamin D, also a known benefit, and hopefully everyone knows that it also helps you with COVID. So for goodness sakes, get your vitamin D level up to about 50 and make sure your doctor checks it. Some doctors will give you pushback, but there's a really good reason right now to check that. There's also a really, really nice findings on a new drug. And this drug is a monoclonal antibody. It's called ofatumumab. They always end in mab, but the names are just getting crazier and crazier. Trade name is going to be Kesimpta with a K. I guess it's going to help with the symptoms, but I would just love to be a fly on the wall in the focus groups where they name drugs. I really would. It has nothing to do with the chemical name, and I've always wondered what the heck's going on with that. So what is this Kesimpta or ofatumumab? It is an antibody targeting the CD20 positive B cells. B cells, by the way, are the ones that help you make antibody. And remember, multiple sclerosis is an antibody-related disease. So if you target the CD20 positive B cells and you reduce the number of them, you get an improvement in multiple sclerosis. This binding is exciting. There's a couple of other drugs already that use it. Ocrelizumab, which is Ocrevus, has been around since 2017, and Rituxan is used off-label for this, and both of them bind to CD20 molecules. Interestingly enough, the Ocrelizumab is actually approved to treat a chronic type of lymphocytic leukemia, so it resulting in beta cell depletion and helping with as a cancer drug. But it is wonderful news for relapsing multiple sclerosis. The study was really pretty good. essentially very, very low relapse rates in the treatment group. They also compared it with a second drug, which worked, but not nearly as well. And we're talking about a 50, almost a 60% improvement in the attack rate. But here's the really exciting news. It appeared to halt new disease activity entirely. In many patients showed no MRI lesions, no disability, no relapses, and it got better over time. It was already highly statistically significant, but when you got into the second year of continuous use, you're looking at an 88% decline in hit rate. And the other cool thing about this is that unlike the alternative drugs, this one can be given by self-injection. So people will be able to give themselves a once-a-month shot. Downside of something like this? Well, what do you think? It's going to be very expensive because, hey, there's that capitalism, which, of course, helps you generate drugs with remarkable speed, sometimes maybe more drugs than you'd particularly like because everybody's grabbing market share. But it does move us forward fast, and this is the system we've set up, so this is the system we've got. I'll take a moment and read an email, this from Emmy in Santa Cruz. How many times do I test my blood sugar after a meal to see how my blood sugar readings change? I'm not diabetic. So I'm not sure whether Emmy is trying to do a keto diet. If you're going to try to stay in ketosis, I recommend actually getting a finger stick ketone meter. The urine strips aren't accurate enough, and if you're going to try to do that, I wouldn't use a blood sugar meter. But if you've got a family history and you're just wanting to make sure that you're not becoming insulin resistant, then a blood sugar meter will give you a sense for your progression. The trick is there's a lot of factors that influence blood sugar. So the combination of what you put in your stomach, if there's a lot of fiber or a lot of fat, the same number of glucose calories or sucrose or whatever you got may take a lot longer to hit the bloodstream, causing the blood sugar to peak at a different time. This is just part of what introduces ambiguity, but to answer your question, in general, after a meal, the blood sugar is going to peak around 90 minutes. It may peak a little earlier, maybe at 60 if it's a very high sugar meal and not much fiber. And that's why, of course, processed foods are such a problem and promote diabetic disease so much, is that a lot, in order to make them crunchy and delicious, a lot of the fiber gets processed away. So I would recommend checking blood sugar immediately before you eat, and then at 30, 60, 90, and 120 minutes, I would do that with a very high glucose meal, a high glycemic meal. An example of that might be some kind of pastry with jam in it, you know, that would be a jelly donut, something like that. That'd be a really good challenge. And watch what the blood sugar does. It shouldn't go above about 170 or 165. If it does, you've already got a little insulin resistance, and you want to pay attention to when it peaked. Was it at 60, 90, 120? When was that peak? Because that is probably the best spot for you to be checking to see how high your blood sugar gets. And like I said, it's usually between 60 to 90 minutes. And oddly enough, little known fact, your blood sugar response to food not only can be affected by that, it can be affected by the time of day. A blood sugar response in the morning will tend to be greater than a blood sugar response in the afternoon. So you'll get a higher blood sugar is what I mean. And actually, if you eat a high carbohydrate meal in the morning, you're likelier to have a worse insulin resistance or a higher blood sugar after the same jelly donut that later that afternoon. It's almost as if the settings on your insulin response are actually affected by the previous meals. So if you're this is how you would check for insulin resistance. Another good thing to do, Emmy, is to check a fasting blood sugar. That's to say when you first get up in the morning. And if that's above 100, then you want to be a little bit concerned. You check it a few different times, but if it's staying in the 100 to 110 range, you probably already have some insulin resistance. I figured out the right question to answer. If I didn't, you can feel free to email me again. This email was sent by filling in the contact us box at askdrdon.com. We're going to turn now to the microbiome because, hey, it's Ask Dr. Don and I love the microbiome. This is some science. It was published in Nature about a year ago. It's been sitting in my basket waiting to be talked about. And what this study looked at was salmonella in mice as the result of feeding an antibiotic to the mice. As you know, there are bacteria that are good bacteria, help us to digest food, and also eat the food and act like ground cover to prevent invasive organisms from getting in and making us sick. When you take oral antibiotics, you get increased colonization by, among other things, salmonella and Clostridium difficile. This is largely because the broad-spectrum antibiotics kill your good flora, or rather deplete them. They don't kill them all, but and they do bounce back, but not quite as well as we'd like. So that allows the pathogens to get a foothold. Antibiotic-related diarrhea, that happens in up to 25% of people treated with antibiotics, particularly the strong ones. But the mechanism for how this works really has not been fully elucidated. And in this study, they saw that the antibiotic streptomycin dramatically increased the level of colon inflammation, and it caused the inflamed cells to actually change their physiology. Remember how we were talking about magnetic fields changing enzyme reactions? Well, in this case, the changes in the cells lining the gut was that the antibiotics caused an increase in nitric oxide synthase, which produced reactive oxygen species. In other words, basically, think hydrogen peroxide, you know, but zizz, 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 bubble, bubble, bubble. These bubbles actually oxidized sugar, glucose, that was present in the gut, creating glucarate and galactarate. So once you oxidize those sugars, they become acids. They were metabolized by E. coli and by salmonella. In other words, you created bacteria chow that was the favorite food for salmonella with your antibiotic. So you end up with the production of other molecules, and these could also be metabolized, and you end up essentially create the ideal bacterial diet for pathogenic bacteria simply through the direct inflammatory result of the antibiotics. So they aren't neutral. They are inflammatory. And how do they do it? They do it by affecting the mitochondria, which are very closely related to bacteria, actually. You can almost think of the mitochondria as being a common ancestor of both humans and bacteria, except that the mitochondria decided to head inside and get out of the rain and develop another type of commensal relationship, which is to say that they make our glucose go a much longer way, allowing for multicellularity and, well, just about all of evolution of large mobile organisms running around the planet. What we really want to do when we are taking antibiotics is try not to let that ground cover be eroded. So if you have, for example, a nice green ground cover and part of it dies, you might want to throw some mulch or some gorilla hair on the bare spot in order to prevent weed seeds from landing on there. Well, essentially, a good gut gardener is going to throw in a lot of ground cover when he or she is taking an antibiotic, and that's how you prevent Clostridia difficile and at least this particular strain of salmonella.
Our next story is an email from Jacqueline from Santa Cruz, and she's also from Germany. I don't know where she is right now. My question a couple of shows ago was about a probiotic for infants called Simbiflor, and whether that would be safe or desirable to use, since infants can't eat that much prebiotic food such as sauerkraut or yogurt. So she continues, I had great results myself taking the Simbiflor at age 14 for gut restoration and eczema. My 7-month-old has similar skin and perhaps gut issues like I had, so I'm wondering if I could give Pro Simbiflor a try. It says it's suitable for infants, but it doesn't give a dosage. Cut in half the listed dosage for adults. Well, Jacqueline, first of all, I want to emphasize that the infant microbiome is substantially different than the adult microbiome. And so anything that isn't specifically intended for infants should not be used. There are infant probiotics out there. They tend to be very, very heavy in bifidobacterium and certain species of lactobacillus. And those species do seem to help quite a bit with the eczema and helping the immune system regulate itself. So I would encourage also lots of breast milk for a 7-month-old. Breast milk is the perfect prebiotic. So a breastfed infant will generally have a much better microbiome and much more resilient microbiome. And if your child has some eczema and you had eczema, probably you just didn't have the world's greatest microbiome to pass along. You probably had antibiotics yourself in childhood, or maybe you even took them for acne, which often people do that for years. And you can almost tell by looking at the species and the sort of fingerprint of which species are there and what their proportions are, that this was an individual who took probiotics. There's also a commonly used antibiotic, unfortunately used quite a lot for penicillin allergic individuals. And this drug, clindamycin, is very likely to cause permanent changes in the microbiome that make you more vulnerable to C. difficile. And so that's lifelong probiotic and therapy after a course of clindamycin to pinch hit for the organisms that have basically gone extinct in that individual's gut. So turning a little bit dark here towards the rest of the program, we're going to turn back to COVID and talk a little bit about COVID hypoxia. What is silent hypoxia? This was something that was reported very early in the years with COVID. We noticed that people would have a very low oxygen, but they didn't feel that short of breath. Of course, other people felt very short of breath and had a normal oxygen. So it was extremely confusing back in the early days. The absence of symptoms, of course, meant that you had to track people using oxygen monitors. I continue, if someone turns positive, I will lend them an oxygen monitor and ask them to watch for a drop in their oxygen, particularly if it goes below 92. I'm quite concerned. But what's going on here? This is something that we didn't actually know was physiologically possible. And there's a phenomenon that we see sometimes, particularly in children who are born with a heart defect, certain kinds of valvular heart disease or holes in the heart, vascular changes in the lungs can also cause this. And what happens in these situations is that the venous blood coming back from the body mixes with the newly oxygenated blood that's coming in from the lungs into the heart and gets pumped out again to the periphery. And in this situation, you have low levels of oxygen, and it's very difficult to get the oxygen to come up because essentially blood is going from the depleted pool back into the oxygenated pool and diluting out the oxygen. This is very serious. The problem was
the COVID wasn't showing the classic changes that we would expect to see on x-rays in the case of this phenomenon, which is called a VQ shunt. They also weren't showing signs of blood clots in the lungs because the COVID blood clots are actually too small. There also appears to be a signaling mechanism that's disabled by the virus, and exactly what's going on there is not clear. But ordinarily, if you got pneumonia and part of your lung was full of pus, the blood vessels in those areas would actually constrict and divert the blood away because the blood wouldn't be able to pick up any oxygen in that area. So it forces the blood to go through the lung tissue that has oxygen, which, you know, allows you to continue to feed oxygen to your brain and the rest of your body. It appears that in COVID-19, this restricting of blood flow, turning off the valve, doesn't occur. And in fact, the opposite happens, opening up increased blood flow through the areas where there is no oxygen to pick up. This is crazy. It's clear that there is multiple things going on, and it takes all of these. It's kind of a perfect storm in order for people to have this problem and have it persist. Our next story, I've got just a couple of minutes, and this one will end on a little tone of hope here, is, you know, we can do designer antibodies. We can also do designer drugs. A group working out of Rush University Medical Center has demonstrated that a peptide, a short chain of amino acids, like a mini protein, squirted into the nose of rats, mouse models with COVID-19, actually prevented infection and reduced the seriousness of the disease. The way this works, it bound the SARS virus, the spike protein, binds to the ACE2 receptor. We all know that. So what they did was they built an ACE2 receptor dummy or decoy. And when you put that in the nose, the virus binds to that. And it also seemed to inhibit the production of the spike protein, of its inflammatory signals that kick up inflammation and are what's partially responsible for potentiating. So if we do get, as I mentioned earlier when we talked about mutation of the virus, if we do get to the point where it becomes an opportunistic and seasonal event, a nasal spray like this that you could use when it gets to your area is a great idea. And we've talked about other things in this program. You can go back, I think about a month ago, and find a discussion of how to dilute down iodine solution like betadine, which is used to sterilize skin. Well, if you dilute it down, it actually seems to reduce your chances of getting COVID. And people in ear, nose, and throat practices have been using it on themselves as practitioners, but also before doing a procedure that's invasive on a patient, and they've seen good results. Also, less scientifically validated but legitimate because of the mechanism involved, is the use of true colloidal silver in your nose. These things keep the virus from getting its hooks into you in the first place. And until everyone is vaccinated, which I think will be sometime late in the summer if we don't have more bad luck, then this is what we need to do. Any port in a storm, they say, and multiple ports, even better. This is Dr. Dawn Motyka saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.